open the House Committee on Human Services on Wednesday, March 25th, 2009. I'd ask you to turn off your cell phones, and please turn them off, not just on mute or vibrate, because it affects the sound system. Turn off your blackberries, your blueberries, your raspberries, strawberries. Okay, and with that, we will open up a public hearing on House Bill 3353. Keeley.
This bill establishes the 15-member Alcohol and Drug Treatment Policy Commission in the Department of Justice. It abolishes the Governor's Council on Alcohol and Drug Abuse and transfers the duties, powers, and funds of the Council to the Commission. Provides for compensation of commission members and requires the commission to report to the governor and interim committees of the legislative assembly.
Thank you, Keely. And we have a group of people who would like to talk with us about this. I would call up Joe O'Leary, John Kroger, and Senator Lori Moniz Anderson. Am I doing that right? Good morning. I'll let you choose in what order you will speak.
I'll just go first since I have to get out of here.
Okay.
And you might take a little longer than I will. Good morning, everyone. I'm Senator Lori Moniz Anderson, and I represent District 25, which is Gresham, Troutdale-Wood Village, and Fairview. And I am here to talk about the bill 3353, House Bill 3353. And basically what I want to say, I serve on the Governor's Council of Drug and Alcohol and been very involved in underage drinking and trying to come up with issues that can address the problem that we have with underage drinking in the state of Oregon. But then Phil Schradel from the AG's office also had a group working on underage drinking, and they were more focused on the law enforcement piece. And to me, I think each one would be far more effective if we could have sort of a coordinated effort. And I think this bill will be able to do that. I think there's still some issues that need to be worked out because we don't want it to be solely law enforcement. And yet we've been quite successful with the domino effect and prevention. But I think the two groups need to talk together. So that's why I feel cautiously optimistic that this is a very good bill. And after testimony, I hope you'll consider moving it. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator.
Chair Tomei, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Joe O'Leary, Senior Policy Advisor to Governor Kulongoski. It's a pleasure to be here before you this morning, speaking in support of House Bill 3353. The bill that is before you was crafted over the last several months in a partnership between Attorney General Kroger and his staff, the Governor's Office, Max Williams, the Director of the Department of Correction, and Bruce Goldberg, the Director of the Department of Human Services, with the very able assistance of the members of the Governor's Alcohol and Drug Council. We have outlined several amendments that will improve the goals of the bill. But let me speak to the goal of the bill, the overarching goal, and why we feel this commission is critically important. We feel the need to improve the system by which publicly funded drug and alcohol treatment and prevention services are delivered in Oregon. There has been lots of work on this front. Senator Moniz Anderson mentioned the domino effect, the product of the council. There's also a year-long study that was just completed, which you received a copy of just a few weeks ago from the organization Human Services Research Institute. That was a study commissioned by the governor to look at the funding streams and the various funding streams of publicly supported drug and alcohol treatment and prevention. We know that we have room for improvement, and this bill is about putting together the right mix of people from across the spectrum, from across human services, public safety, prevention, and treatment sectors, both local and state government, to enhance our coordination, to get a better handle on our outcomes, and ultimately to enhance public safety, enhance our workforce and thus our economy, to enhance the services we provide to children and families, and ultimately to save lives. Our hope is that this will very much build on the work of the council, and we very much would appreciate your support. Thank you.
Thank you, Joe.
Chair Tomei, members of the committee, I'm John Kroger. I'm the Attorney General of Oregon. From a law enforcement perspective, the single highest priority for the state is reducing illegal drug consumption. And the reason for that is very simple. It is the number one driver of our criminal justice system. It is the single biggest cause of property crime in the state. It's the single biggest cause of child abuse. And the impact on our society of our illegal drug addiction problem extends well beyond the criminal justice system. Obviously, it has a huge impact on child welfare in the state and on the viability and productivity of our workforce. Over the last 30 years, the country has basically approached this as a supply problem, that we've used law enforcement and foreign policy to try to control the supply of drugs coming into the country, the supply of drugs on the street. And the overwhelming consensus in the law enforcement community that's evolved over those 30 years is that efforts to control drug supplies is insufficient. You also have to have a serious effort to control local demand for drugs if you're going to make any progress. You can see the reason that we've reached that conclusion, not just nationally, but here in Oregon. The effort to put pseudoephedrine behind the counters of pharmacies was very successful. It basically eliminated overwhelmingly about 95% of the amateur local home cooking of methamphetamine in the state, which was a huge success. And nothing I say is meant to criticize that effort. It's been a triumph. The problem is that if you have demand for drugs, which is very high, and you eliminate the local supply, and that's what we did, drugs are just a commodity like any other. You create a market opportunity for someone else to supply them. Right now, methamphetamine, despite that effort and the elimination of local production, is widely available here in Oregon. It's supplied overwhelmingly by Mexican drug cartels who are operating in Portland, in Salem, in Eugene, in Roseburg, in Medford, and Bend. And so all the negative social consequences, particularly of meth use, haven't decreased despite the success of that bill. That's just an example of the problem of focusing just on law enforcement efforts to limit supply. You've also got to decrease the demand for drugs. And that means very successful prevention and treatment programs. I think our treatment and prevention effort in the state can be dramatically improved, and I think we need to improve it if we're serious about cutting the amount of crime that we have in the state and all of the costs associated with crime. The problem is not with the treatment community or the treatment providers. Individually, those programs are generally, I think, very well run and get good results. The problem is the overall system or framework in which those programs exist. I think we have four current problems with our system where we could improve. One is simply in access to drug treatment. Right now, in the state, we have teenagers who are turned away from drug treatment centers because of a lack of access. We have parents who go to drug treatment centers and are sent away because we don't have the capability to provide services. We have families that I've met who've had to move from Oregon to Washington simply because they have a better drug treatment system there and they were able to get family members into treatment when it was unavailable here. And finally, we have a lot of people in the criminal justice system who desperately need to be in drug treatment, and we could cut the recidivism rate if we could get more of them into drug treatment. The federal government accounts for and collect statistics on access to drug treatment, even with significant increases in treatment spending over the last few biennia. Oregon remains every year in the bottom quarter or bottom third of states. That's actually an improvement over time. In 2002, we were 49th in the nation in terms of access to drug treatment for children and young adults. We've shown improvement, but we still have a long way to go in terms of access. Second, I think we could improve accountability of our programs. The most successful programs around the United States require, as part of funding, that the programs that are funded collect uniform statistics on outcomes so that you can track over time the success of the programs and which programs are being successful and which ones are not. And we have a long way to go in that effort. I was at a drug treatment center a couple of weeks ago in Portland. Again, I'm not criticizing this program. It's a very successful program, I think. But one of the challenges, I asked the director of the program whether they were tracking outcomes, and the response was, well, we're not required to track outcomes as part of our contract. And I said, okay, I understand that. How do you know that the program is working? And the direct quote I received is, well, we're throwing money out there and hoping. And that is not sufficient. That is not sufficient, nor is it a correct structure for success. We've got to be able to have greater accountability so we can ensure that these programs succeed. Third, I think we could have more careful prioritization of our funding to make sure that our dollars are going to the most successful programs, particularly in times of very tough budget limitations. I think that prioritization could be improved. And finally, and I think this is the most fundamental area, right now I do not believe, despite all of our efforts, that we have a first-rate or a nationwide leading drug treatment program. And what I think we need is a strategic plan to get the state moving in that direction. For all these reasons, I think it would be a great idea to have the proposed statewide commission on treatment and prevention programs in our state, in part because I think a commission would be very valuable in order to bring ideas to the legislature about how we can move in the direction of having a truly world-class treatment and prevention program. I think it would really do two things. First, it would make sure that all of the relevant parties are around the table at one time, not just law enforcement, not just the treatment community, but counties as well, in particular, because the counties remain a very important deliverer of these services. I think it's also important because it would give us the time to put our programs in a national context and try to draw some of the lessons from successful programs elsewhere in the country. There are several states that have outstanding models that we can learn from, and I think we would be greatly benefited from having an opportunity to borrow some of those ideas. I think at the end of the day, the biggest goal of the commission would be to bring a blueprint to the legislature for how we can improve in this area. It is not easy. Treatment and prevention programs aren't a silver bullet, but if the effort is successful to improve our treatment and prevention programs, I think you'd see two very important results. One is that you would actually reduce crime. And as someone who is both a former prosecutor and someone who spent a lot of time studying and teaching the criminal justice system, I'm confident, based on 30 years of data from a lot of jurisdictions, that that is true. And second, you'll save money. It is just a fact. Drug treatment is an extraordinarily cost-efficient way to reduce crime and the social consequences of addiction. States around the country save between $4 and $7 in other state programs for every dollar they invest in drug treatment. You have lower enforcement costs, lower corrections costs, lower health care costs, lower costs in your child welfare programs. And so I think this would be a way for us to move as a state in the direction of spending less money responding to crime and thus freeing up more funds for the legislature to invest in the kind of things that are going to make the state stronger. So for those reasons, I think this is an important step. It's a you know, a challenging time, I think, budgetarily, and ultimately I think an increase in funding is going to be necessary, particularly to improve access. But I think we can use this period where funds are tight to try to lay the foundation, the groundwork for building a truly world-class program. And I think that would be of true benefit to our state. Thank you very much for letting me testify, and I'd be happy to answer any questions that the committee might have.
Thank you, Mr. Attorney General. Any questions of either of these witnesses? Representative Van Orman.
Thank you, Chair Tomei. Thank you, Attorney General Kroger. I am very impressed with your grasp of the problems that we have in this area. And I also, as a former Head Start director in Oregon and in Washington, I can testify to you that, in fact, it is different. And that when we have Head Start parents who have difficulties, that Washington does have a better system than Oregon. One of the questions that I have for you, of course, though, is that is in regards to the effectiveness of a commission, because sometimes there are titles only. And I will say that in Hood River County, we have probably, well, we actually do have a nationally recognized alcohol, tobacco, and drug treatment or prevention program for kids. And it's been nationally recognized for its effectiveness. Even so, it still comes down to what you say is money. So in your vision of this commission, do you see it can be an effective instrument of change?
Chair Tomei, Representative Van Orman, if I may, I think it could be an extraordinarily powerful vehicle for change, and I don't say that lightly. I think all of us who've been involved in government at various levels have had experiences of being involved in task forces and commissions, which at the end of the day make good recommendations but ultimately don't bring real progress. I think the reason that the governor's office and myself have reached the conclusion that this would be a powerful way to bring some change in this area is that when you talk with various people about how to make progress, I don't think anyone has an overarching vision of all the different pieces. I think a lot of different communities have a very good grasp of one piece. The law enforcement community sees one aspect of the problem. The treatment community sees another piece. And I think I think all of us felt that we weren't prepared to come to the legislature this session with what we think that great blueprint for the state's future in this area would be. But all of us are confident that if we had the right players around the table and sufficient funding for professional staff to help us study the successes in other states, that this would be an important vehicle to bring some progress. And I think, quite frankly, the legislative mandate here I view as being critical to this. I think there's a very big difference between the executive branch retiring on its own to produce a blue ribbon report that could or could not be implemented by the legislature. I think it's a different thing if that commission comes with the support of the legislature and a legislatively mandated mission to go away, prepare a strategic game plan for the legislature, and to bring it back to the very committees that proposed and supported the commission in the first place. So I think for that reason this is potentially a very powerful tool for us to help build on the programs that we have in place and make them much more effective.
Thank you.
Representative Cowan.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think for the record, I need to put out there that I also serve on the existing Governor's Council on Alcohol and Drug Abuse, and I'm glad that you brought the members representing that council finally into the conversation. I think bringing this forward without that initial conversation was a little bit premature. This is a group, and there are many others, who have recognized the critical need for additional treatment and prevention services for a very long time. I guess I'm glad somebody else is noticing at this point, but it's a little bit concerning in the direction this came forward, so I hope that we can work out some of those pieces. I've talked to providers for a long time, and I don't think they would all support the, quote, throwing money out there and hoping. I think there are far more outcome-oriented providers than is recognized in that particular quote, and I'm a little concerned about that. What we've recognized is that there's a need for additional money for these challenges, and so I guess my question specifically is how much you anticipate this particular bill and the sufficient staff to do this kind of a coordination effort, how much you would anticipate that to cost.
Chair Timlay, Representative Cowan, I first let me say that I agree with you completely that, that many of the programs in the state are very result-driven. I think from a systematic point of view, one of the challenges is the lack of uniformity in the way the data is compiled by various different programs makes it very difficult to do the kind of rigorous prioritization that one would, would do. I didn't mean to throw that out there and with a broad brush, but it was a meeting I had 2 weeks ago, and it has been very much in my mind since then. In terms of the funding, I would defer to Mr. Goldberg, who's going to testify, because, you know, at the end of the day, I think this program should be based in his agency, and I would think that the product would result would be heavily influenced by the work that's already been done at DHS. I think the you know, the ballpark figures that we have discussed in order to have the necessary professional staff to make this a success might be somewhere in the range of $400,000 to $700,000. But if I may, defer to him in terms of the discussion of the budget.
I'll follow very briefly. Yeah. I will then defer the rest of my questions. I just want to roll out there that in the current structure in the bill, I'm a little concerned about the ratio between those in the provider community and those in the law enforcement community that are that's laid out in the bill and sort of the structure of the whole thing. So I'll wait until...
And we do have some amendments that are in the process.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you so much, gentlemen. Appreciate you coming. And now we have Bruce Goldberg and Multnomah County Chair Ted Wheeler.
Good morning,
Good
Chair
morning.
Tomei and members of the committee. My name is Ted Wheeler. I'm the chairman of the Board of County Commissioners of Multnomah County, and I appreciate the opportunity to come here in support of House Bill 3353 for the purposes of creating a statewide alcohol and drug policy commission. First of all, let me just say that I agree entirely with Attorney General Kroger that we need a comprehensive assessment of the way we provide both treatment and prevention services around drug and alcohol abuse, not only locally but statewide. There is no question in my mind that public safety and treatment are indisputably linked, and we need to be able to more thoughtfully approach our means of serving those who have addiction needs, and we need to be more thoughtful in terms of how we target our financial resources to make sure that we're most cost-effectively addressing the public safety needs of the community. I was asked if I could just briefly share some information from Multnomah County about our own experience. On any given day, we have about 8,000 offenders under supervision in the community. We have approximately 1,400 people incarcerated in our jail facilities. We know that about 75% of those offenders have, in fact, committed criminal activities based on their drug and alcohol addictions. We know that if we do not address those drug and alcohol addictions, they're likely to go back into the community and reoffend. We have, in fact, done some studies at our Department of Community Justice that supervises those in the community. We looked at 5,000 of our folks who are on probation and post-prison supervision. Of the 5,000, 2,300 offenders had a higher medium need for treatment and posed a significant risk to reoffending. For all of us, that's an important policy issue because we know that the vast majority of people in the criminal justice system in Multnomah County will come back to our community, and we want to know what's going to happen once they return. And the hard truth is that many, if not most, of those individuals will reoffend. We also know that that's not just a Multnomah County problem. I hold it up as an example, given that we're the second largest correction system in the state behind the Oregon Department of Corrections. We're the largest provider of community supervision in the state of Oregon, but we know that the experience is shared statewide and even nationwide. The National Institute of Justice did a recent study that showed that over 50% of violent crimes, 60 to 80% of child abuse and neglect cases, 50 to 70% of theft and property crimes, and fully 75% of drug dealing and manufacturing offenses involve offender drug use. We also know, as the Attorney General noted, that treatment and prevention programs are extremely cost-effective. At this point, that's no longer in dispute by anybody. Recent research by the RAND Corporation, the National Institute on Drug Abuse, the Washington State Institute for Public Policy, and the Justice Policy Institute in Washington, D.C. all confirm that alcohol and drug treatment is highly cost-effective. The one study that caught my interest was the one by the Washington State Institute for Public Policy. In Washington State, they already have a comprehensive approach and means of assessing the outcomes and performance of drug and alcohol treatment programs statewide. And one of the studies they conducted recently showed that treatment is extremely beneficial in terms of cost savings. For every dollar spent on drug treatment in the community, they estimated a return as high as $18.52 in terms of benefits. They looked at a broader array of issues, including criminal justice costs and savings to taxpayers. There's also no question that failing to provide adequate treatment and a framework for analyzing and evaluating that treatment can be a costly mistake. There's been studies that look at the opportunity costs of not providing treatment and support services to juvenile offenders. Those studies have concluded that over the lifetime of a criminal offender, the cost to society can be approximately $1.7 million per offender. For obvious reasons, Multnomah County wants to be a leader when it comes to responding to the needs of addicted offenders for both adults and juveniles. At any given time, we have approximately 500 adult offenders who are participating in outpatient treatment services or residential services. We serve about 1,500 of those offenders per year, and about 250 juveniles received those same services in Multnomah County. So the results tend to be very positive. The downside, of course, it always comes down to the money. And we all understand in this room that the demand for treatment services far outstrips the capacity of the programs that provide those services. And as a result, the Attorney General is right. We need to make sure that we're targeting our precious, our limited treatment dollars to those programs that work, that are the most effective, and that deliver the best bang for the buck in terms of outcomes. A concern that we all have in Multnomah County is that these very programs that we've spent years creating, and I also want to address the accountability issue by saying yes, and spending an awful lot of time and energy developing comprehensive accountability and outcome systems for those programs are currently at risk. I would say they're code red in terms of some of the potential cuts that they could experience this year, either at the state level or at the local level. So it's doubly important that we support House Bill 3353 and get this comprehensive and thoughtful discussion underway right now so that we as a state can make informed decisions about how best to target and support drug and alcohol policy in the state of Oregon. I'm certainly happy to take any questions any members of the committee may have, and I thank you for this opportunity to testify in behalf of what I think is a very important effort. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Wheeler. I'm going to hold questions, colleagues. Yes.
Mr. Head of DHS.
That's more titles than I deserve. For the record, Bruce Goldberg, Director of the Department of Human Services. Chair Tomei, members of the committee, here this morning to testify in support of this bill, and I think I'm sort of represent in many ways the third piece of this in terms of you've heard from elected officials, you've heard from the criminal justice perspective on this, and let me provide a little bit of understanding from the human services side of this. Substance abuse affects everyone in our state, and the human and social effects of that and consequences are enormous. And you've heard some of that. Let me give you my couple of quick, pithy statistics. 260,000 people in this state have a substance abuse problem, and the ripples of that are enormous. It goes out and it affects our families, our public programs. It affects everyone in the state. It directly affects those people who have those problems, because they get sick, and quite frankly, this is a technical term, they die. It has an enormous consequence, and this is preventable, and it's treatable. Treatment works. Within the human service arena, the ripple effects of substance abuse and addictions are enormous. This is a root cause problem for just about all of our programs. In child welfare, which is an enormous piece of our mission, 60% of kids in the child welfare system are there because their parents have untreated substance abuse or mental health problems. Within healthcare, millions of dollars of healthcare costs are driven by untreated and unprevented substance abuse and addiction. The safety of our seniors is impacted by the substance abuse and addiction problems of caretakers and of family members. Within the state as a whole, it's estimated that $800 million of healthcare costs are the direct result of untreated substance abuse, and we have almost $1 billion in costs in our criminal justice system, as well as in our child welfare system and our social programs, that could be averted by treating substance abuse better. So this has an enormous ripple effect, and what it forces us to do is to really divert scarce resources towards the end stage. Here's the example I give almost every day. So I indicated to you that 60% of kids in the child welfare system are there because their parents have untreated substance abuse problems. Well, the costs of that are $16,000 a year for a child in our foster care system, year after year. If their parent is incarcerated, that's additional. Superintendent Williams and I have been working quite a bit on this. It's about $25,000 a year, I believe. The cost of treatment is far less than that and quite effective. And so by failing to really approach this from a root cause perspective, we're collectively as a state not doing our job. You know, we can do better. We have to do better. This is a real imperative for us. We've got to really deal with the issue of treatment, and we have to even move further upstream and deal with the issue of prevention and preventing this and putting the resources into substance abuse prevention programs. Our current system is fragmented. This is a diagram of our current alcohol and drug treatment prevention funding system. And I don't put this out there to, point fingers at anybody or anything. We're certainly a part of this. But I think it speaks to the need for this bill, and I'll get to that in a moment. But we've got a fragmented system. This is actually from a report that Joe O'Leary mentioned, supported by Max Williams and myself, who, as I indicated, have been working together for the last couple of years, because I think we've come to certainly the understanding that, you know, this is an Oregon problem. It's not a human services problem. It's not a law enforcement problem. It's an Oregon problem, and that many of the Max and I are taking care of the same families. We're just doing it in different ways, and we've got to look at how we do that smarter. So we supported this study. You know, in many ways, you can use whatever language you like, but it supported many of the issues that Attorney General Kroger raised. It, in essence, said we need to improve access. Put another way, there are many, many people out there who need treatment who aren't getting it. It pointed to a need for greater accountability. I would put that as follows, that we haven't kind of coordinated all these resources. We haven't put the money into an infrastructure to support evidence-based practice and to improve a lot of the data linkages that we need to understand better where and how to put our resources. It talked about prioritization, absolutely. I mean, I'm proud to tell you today that for the first time over the last 2 years, we began to prioritize treatment within our department and took some dollars and prioritized that to treat parents who children are at risk of going into our foster care system. And it's been remarkably successful, and I hope at some point someone can come back on another day and talk to you about some of the outcomes of that. But it's been a great program because we've started to prioritize some of that. And then I think lastly, we do need to have a plan. But let me go one step further, because I think we can't just have a plan, and I think this gets at what Representative Van Orman mentioned. I don't think anyone's looking for a plan that sits on a shelf. You know, I've got a lot of sagging bookshelves that have a lot of dust on them, that have a lot of plans, and I've been to far too many meetings when people roll out the plan before the plan before the plan. So this isn't really about a plan. It's about another issue. It's really about political support, and it's about reframing the problem, getting everyone in the state together, stopping to look at these issues as whether or not they're criminal justice issues or treatment issues or human services issues, and getting together and saying this is an Oregon issue, we've got to reframe the problem, we've got to get everybody around the table that has a piece in this, we need to put together a plan, and more importantly, We've got to generate the widespread knowledge and political support to actually move it forward. Is this bill a guarantee? No, I don't think anything's a guarantee. But certainly, we need to do better, and we need to. We can't keep doing what we've been doing for the last several decades. We can do better. We have to do better. This is really an imperative, and I think what this bill really is the opportunity to bring together leaders from across the spectrum and build on what's been the great work of the Governor's Council and the domino effect one and two, and to build on what's been a great foundation and to move forward with this. And with that, I will take any questions.
Thank you. Colleagues, in the interest of time, I'm feeling some pressure here. We have a lot of people who are going to be here to testify on other bills. And so I can imagine that we do have a lot of questions, and I'd like some feedback from you. What I'd like to do, perhaps, is if you have questions for either of these two gentlemen, maybe you could put them through Keeley, and she can provide them to them, and we can get written responses back. Would that work for you?
Are we anticipating amendments that we don't have today?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
I think we could come back and discuss it further with
the amendments. We will have another hearing, so there will be another chance. But I know Chair
Wheeler,
thank you. I'm going to say Ted Williams, but I think that's a...
Oh, I wish. I wish.
Right. We get some autographs. It would be harder to bring him back, but if we had questions. Does that work for the committee? Great. Thank you so much
Thank
for your
you.
Testimony
Appreciate it.
Today. So we have Judy Cushing, Stephanie. Right.
Do you want to represent the counselors, or do you want to hold up? I mean, you can pause the panel and come back to it.
Okay, that's a good idea. Okay, what we're going to do, Judy, that's fine. We're going to take a pause. I see that Representative Gelser is here. I heard she came in. Stand up.
There by the door.
She's standing.
Great. So we're going to take a pause right now. Judy, we'll come back to this. So I'm going to briefly close the hearing on House Bill 3353 and open up the work session on House Bill 2442.
Mm-hmm.
Hello, Representative. This has been a long journey for you.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Sarah Gelser, the state representative from Corvallis and Philomath. And I cannot tell you how delighted I am to bring you the final set of amendments for House Bill 2442, which many of you on this panel have been working with me on, and a lot of people that are in this room for more than a year and a half. And I think we finally have it at the place where it is ready to go forward. And I'd like to talk you through the three amendments that I would recommend that you adopt to this bill before moving it forward. And Madam Chair, I understand that Legislative Fiscal was not able to complete the fiscal statement, and that maybe today would be a day you could adopt the amendments and wait for the fiscal to come and send it on its merry way to Ways and Means then.
That is my intent. Colleagues.
Great. Thank you. The first and primary amendment, which is the really thick one in front of you, is the Dash 9 amendment. And what this bill does, and I'd particularly like to thank Fred Steele of the Department of Human Services, this amendment makes necessary corrections. You'll remember that we went through and adjusted the definitions of abuse, and Fred and other folks at the department worked very hard to make sure that all of these were tight and orderly and were providing the best possible protection for folks while also not throwing our counties and our protective service program into disarray with any unintended new populations or new definitions of abuse. A couple of other significant changes from when we came before. You'll remember when you heard this bill the first time, we talked about centralizing the protective services investigations for the developmental disability population. What we've done instead, working with the department and with some of the counties, is to instead put into statute some clear language about standards for those investigations statewide. And what this will do is allow the counties to continue to do them, but they must ensure that a person that is a case manager does not also do the protective service investigations, and that these investigators, except for in cases of emergencies, have only that single responsibility of doing the investigations. Those are the primary changes which are in the Dash 9 amendment. Lots of technical fixes that are in there. The next amendment that I would point, and in the Dash 9 amendment, we also took out in Section 6, which had to do with the criminal convictions that people might have that would bar them from employment. We took out the misdemeanor property crime types of things, forging a check, credit card fraud. The only misdemeanors which remain in there are those which apply directly to this population. These would be things like criminal mistreatment, which has to do with withholding care from a vulnerable population. It also retains the invasion of personal privacy, which is the videotaping without knowledge of the intimate parts of another person's body, and that is a particular vulnerability for this population of people. That is something that we'll have to watch carefully in the implementation. It is not the intention to pick up, you know, kids that do goofy things with cell phones. In the case of all of those things, it's important to clarify. If you go and apply to have your record expunged because you've done a ridiculous thing when you're young and that is expunged from your record, that would no longer preclude you from having one of these jobs. If it's expunged, it is, in fact, expunged. The next amendment that I would point out to you is the dash 2.
May I ask a question before she moves? May I ask why you've removed the property crime piece? Because it seems to me that someone working in close context with someone, this is part of the problem. There are thefts, et cetera, that kind of thing. So,
correct. Thank you, Madam Chair, Representative Boone. I agree that this remains a significant area of vulnerability. We have left in felony identity theft. What became difficult was how do you distinguish between a young person that takes their parents' credit card and they end up prosecuted for that, or a check? Do we really want to, for that, completely preclude someone from working in a workforce that it is sometimes difficult to recruit in? For all of the other crimes, the department will continue doing its fitness test, where they will get that criminal background and they will compare that to the job that the person is getting. The reason it's important to do it for these other ones is the department does these weight tests. The individual client employers, they don't necessarily know the background of the folks or know what that criminal record is. So the things that remain are the things like murder and rape and sexual assault and those others that I mentioned to you, the invasion of personal privacy and the or private indecency, I'm sorry, and the criminal mistreatment.
Follow up. If someone,
very briefly,
thank you. If someone does have a conviction for that, wouldn't that count? Wouldn't that come into play?
Chair Tomei, Representative Boone, do you mean that for one of the financial crime things? It would, Madam Chair, it would come into play when the Department of Human Services did the criminal background check and their criminal records unit did that did that weight test. This was part of a compromise. I know that concerns were raised last time about how stringent did we want to be on precluding people from employment in the future, and this was our best effort at trying to hit that middle ground. I would say there are people that continue to be a little bit uncomfortable on both sides of that issue, which to me smacks of a good compromise.
Okay.
So the next amendment that I would point out to you is the dash 2 amendment. It's on that same area. In the last hearing, you'll remember that Andrea Meyer of the ACLU had offered testimony sharing her concerns both with those criminal convictions and the retention of fingerprints, since there was some concern that that would set a new precedent. The Department of Human Services also didn't have the capability at this point to implement that, so this removes that retention of the fingerprint cards and addresses that concern. And I do also want to clarify for the record that it is a, although TSPC does do the criminal conviction prohibitions for its teachers, this is another vulnerable person, and I certainly don't want to give the impression that I think that for all jobs everywhere, if you have a crime that you've been convicted of, that you should not be able to be employed. This is a very unique and vulnerable population, and we're talking about crimes that are specific to them. And then the last amendment that I have before you is the dash 7 amendment, and this relates to, at the end part of the bill, we increased the minimum civil penalty in the case of egregious abuses like rape, serious injury, or abuse that results in death. And we set that minimum penalty at $2,500. We tried to reach and I really want to thank both the Oregon Healthcare Association, SEIU, and the Department of Human Services, who all worked very hard to try to come to a solution that everyone could agree on. I would say at this point there is a difference of opinion, and I would say the dash 7 represents the road that the Oregon Healthcare Association and SEIU are most comfortable with. The dash 9, without the dash 7, likely represents the path that the department is most comfortable with. The difference between the two of them are is creating a cap per quarter of how much of a penalty can be set upon an individual facility for these types of abuses. So in the Dash 7 amendment, it creates a $15,000 cap for the total number of these minimum $2,500 fines that can be assessed in a 90-day period. That cap does not exist in the Dash 7 amendment. And that would apply to all programs with the exception of adult foster care. The minor amendment there is where in all of the other settings, it's a minimum penalty of $2,500, and an adult foster care facility where $2,500 is often more than the rate that they're paid, it is $2,500. So it's both a floor and a cap, and that was negotiated with SEIU. And these are the amendments. That was a lot of information. I'm happy to quickly answer questions you might have.
Quick question.
Did you mean in Dash 9 that the $15,000 cap doesn't, you said in Dash 7, but I'm reading in Dash 7 that it does have the cap. It was not in Dash 9?
Correct. The Dash 9 does not include, a cap. So that if the committee, basically we've commended this to the committee. In the Dash, if you want to put a cap on the quarterly fines, that would be the Dash 7. And the arguments from those proponents are that in a time of economic decline, it's very scary to have these fines come onto them without a limited cap. The argument from those that are proponents of not adopting the Dash 7 would be that the fines go directly into this quality care fund and that the public and the legislature holds the department accountable and gets very angry with them when the public perceives that they have not appropriately fined in an egregious case and that we would be tying their hands to do that. I think they both make good arguments, and that's why I bring you both options.
Madam Chair. I'm sorry, and you know I was out sick yesterday, and I'm trying to track.
Yes.
Did we just get these this morning, or have they been circulated prior to today?
Did we just get them this morning?
I emailed them yesterday or Monday, and then wanted to provide hard copies this morning.
Yeah, that was it. Yeah.
And did I understand you to say you want to move this today?
I want to move the amendments because Representative Gelser has been working with all the stakeholders. I think we're not coming out with a bill that everybody is totally 100% supportive of, but I think that everybody has something to complain about, but everybody has something to support. So what I'd like to do is pass the amendments today, and you're suggesting that we support all three amendments, right?
Yes, Madam Chair.
Right. And I'd like to pass the amendments today. We'll have another work session in the future after we get the fiscal, and then we can discuss it further then. But we can't move ahead until we approve the amendments. So that's what I'd like to get your agreement on today.
And Madam Chair,
yes.
What I failed to mention to you in the comments, I know that Legislative Fiscal is working furiously to try to get the fiscal put together. I did speak with the department, and the general fund fiscal in this biennium on the bill in total would be about $255,000.
Okay.
For the total bill. And I believe that James Taves is here as well if you have
questions
about that.
Right, and we will ask James to come up and speak with us. But this does not commit you to voting for the bill either here or on the floor, but I would like, so that we can move along with this, so that I'd like you to approve this.
If we approved all of the, and then we would come back in the work session and narrow it down to?
No, these will be the bill. These three amendments will be the bill. Am I correct, Representative?
Madam Chair, yes, that would be my preference.
And then, but
I guess I'm lost because I thought with Dash 7 and Dash 9 it would be an either or.
No. Madam Chair, may I clarify?
Yes.
So the Dash 9 would be the base bill. It's basically a revision of that original bill that you got. The Dash 7 isn't compatible. It's like an add-on to the Dash 9. It's completely complementary. You would adopt the two together if you chose to put a quarterly cap on the fines. And they are written that way so that they can ride together.
And we can certainly have more discussion on this, but I would like to get at least this in the record. This will become the bill so that we can discuss it further at the next work session.
Representative.
Technical question.
Sure.
I don't see how the dash sevens and the dash nines mesh around the cap, because the dash nine, when you're looking at page 26 and the fine, you're addressing ORS 443.775. And the dash sevens change ORS 441.715.
Madam Chair, Representative.
I don't have everything. I can't lay it all out. To me, it just seems like now you've got two RS is saying two different things, and you kind of pick the one you want.
No, Madam Chair, Representative Maurer, if I may. But what the dash 7 does and what the dash 9 does, because you're talking about a whole series of different service settings, as you move through the dash 9 and through 2442, it addresses a whole series of ORSs, and the dash 7 hits all of those. Because you're talking about long-term care facilities, you're talking about assisted living facilities, you're talking about adult foster care, and they are each in different sections of the law. And I can make a, not right here, but I could make a little tree for you.
And also, by the time we have the next work session, all of it would be in one bill.
It would all be engrossed in one bill. And Legislative Council drafted these two pieces to be compatible with one another. And all of the stakeholders have pored over these with, I can assure you, extraordinarily great detail.
Okay. I'll accept that.
Well, but he, you know, Madam Chair, Representative Maurer makes a good point, though. I mean, there just doesn't seem to be the connection.
I think at this point I'd like to give Representative Gelser and Elsie a chance to mesh all of these together and come back with us at a later work session so we can work this more thoroughly. Can we agree to that? Great. I appreciate that. Thank you. Okay. Anything more, Representative?
No, thank you, and thank you for your patience. This is a complicated bill.
It is.
I also believe this is a very important bill that is going to improve the safety of the thousands of adults with developmental disabilities that rely on us to keep them safe. These are much-needed changes, and I'm very grateful to all of the stakeholders that have worked very hard to get this into a implementable format.
Yes, this has been a very painful, laborious process for everybody involved, I think. Okay.
Madam Chair, that the fiscal, that you just the number, I mean, that's a big deal.
We'll hear more about that.
Okay.
I promise. We'll have as much time as we need. Okay.
Motion.
Yes, please.
Madam Chair, I move to adopt the dash two amendments.
Do we need to hear from James before we adopt these, or is it okay to
adopt
these first?
We're not in work session at this point, are we?
Yeah, but I can have invited testimony.
I believe that James has something to... I think James wanted to clarify or wanted to expound on the difference between the dash 7 and the dash 9.
What I'd like to do is move these right now and then bring James up.
Okay.
Representative.
Do you want all three then?
Can we do all three at once?
Yeah. Okay. Madam Chair, I move to adopt the dash 2 amendments dated March 17, 2009. The dash 2 amendment stated March 17th, 2009, the dash 7 amendment stated March 19th, 2009, and the dash 9 amendments dated March 23rd, 2009.
Representative Boone moves to adopt the dash 2 amendment stated March 17th, 2009, dash 7 amendments March 19th, 2009, and dash 9 amendments dated March 23rd, 2009. Any discussion? Representative.
Madam Chair, I think the committee needs to hear from the department before they vote on these amendments.
Okay. All right. So how do I deal with that?
Just let James go ahead and come up and
great.
We'll hold the motion.
Okay, we'll hold that motion until James. Is James here? I thought I saw him earlier. Oh, there you are. Hi, James.
Okay. Madam Chair, members of the committee, James Tays from the Department of Human Services. And I'll be extremely brief, and we appreciate the work of Representative Gelser and all the stakeholders on this. And we support the amendments with the exception of the Dash 7s. And we urge that you not adopt the Dash 7s, which would cap the civil penalties. And I want to be real clear about the department's position on this. We have worked very hard with all of our providers, and we recognize the precarious financial situation. We worked during the special supplemental session last February to significantly increase the rates across the community-based care, community provider system. So this is not about the department wanting to set really high civil penalties and destabilize the financial condition providers. But this is one of the tools that we believe we need to deal with really, really significant situations that arise. Not in good providers, the vast majority of service providers do a great job, and not in situations where there's just a rogue employee who may commit a really horrendous act. We're talking about situations where something really awful happens to the person, and that is now defined, actually, in the amendments, really awful that happens in which the agency was fully aware or culpable in that. A very brief example, for example, is a woman with developmental disabilities with severe seizures who required 15-minute checks throughout the day, given her precarious situation, left in a bathtub all night long, found unresponsive in the middle of the night, was dead by morning, 9/11, never called. When the owner was finally notified, he came over and basically worked with the staff to prepare how they would defend themselves when the police finally arrived. And under this particular bill, that was a foster home, we would assess a $2,500 civil penalty. Similarly, in other cases, we've had, in one case, a woman dropped 6 days later after crying out in pain, finally hospitalized, found with multiple breaks in her legs, contusions everywhere. She died in the hospital. The hospital said that the pain level when she came was simply off the chart. So again, we're not looking at across-the-board civil penalties. We're looking at very serious, egregious cases where there's a high level of culpability. And our proposal was to simply take the $2,500 as a floor, probably set a ceiling. CMS, for example, in its guidelines on nursing homes, talks about a $3,500 to a $10,000 range. But then you calibrate that range again based on the level of culpability, because again, if there's a rogue employee in an otherwise really good facility, doesn't show up in a criminal record check, but still commits a horrific act, that's different than an agency having full knowledge that the person was in severe pain, not having taken action to prevent the pain or the death or the sexual abuse, whatever that might be. So I think for that reason, we think these penalties simply are not capping it at the $15,000 amount, simply isn't commensurate with these kinds of levels of incidents, and we would prefer to go through rulemaking through a more flexible approach that would be fully transparent, working with the providers. We'd be happy to report back to the legislature on how a range of penalties might actually work and how the level of culpability would be calibrated within that. In closing, I think... the legislature, the media, consumers, families have been very critical at times of the department for not acting aggressively when people are really harmed. And I agree with that. I think we have at times not taken the actions we need to take. But again, this is not impugning our provider community or the industry. They do a phenomenal job. They are stakeholders. We are grateful for the work they do. This is about really egregious cases that cry for attention from all of us. So with that, I would urge you not adopt the Dash 7s.
Thank you. Representative Huffman.
James, it sounds like one of the examples, the death in the bathtub, that there are, this provider is going to have a lot more to deal with than a $2,500 fine, criminal charges, whatever. I guess I'm not tracking. At $2,500 per occurrence, if they're up to $15,000, we shouldn't be worried about $2,500 or $15,000. We're going to be looking at their license to do business. So I think it's a moot point to care about what the cap is. If it's $15,000, it shouldn't be up to $15,000. If we've got situations like that, we should be looking at their license. So I think your argument's moot.
Madam Chair, Representative Huffman, in that case, actually, I would agree with you, and we did strip the license from that particular provider, and within several days, we had moved all the residents out and pulled the license and actually worked with the DA on criminal charges, which unfortunately were later dropped. But again, when we look at these situations, even in the case where there's a high level of culpa, in this particular case, I think was simply off the chart, and I'm very disappointed that they didn't proceed with criminal charges. But even in other situations, you can have a really good facility, and it's more than a rogue employee where the staff and others knew that something was going on, reported something was not done. But when we go back and we look at the sort of the record over time, we find they have done otherwise a really good job, so we wouldn't necessarily pull the license as the immediate step. And in some cases, in this particular case that I just cited, that was a five-person foster home. Shutting that down, moving the people is much simpler to do when you have a nursing home or a residential care facility with 50 or 75 or 100 people. But we also have other tools that are just, we're working on a bill this session to clean up and expedite the means by which we can actually go to court, have a trustee appointed, even in a troubled facility, to go in and take over that facility. So I'm not trying to suggest civil penalties in and of themselves are the cure-all here at all. It's simply a range of options that I think we can use. But again, having a civil penalty, which have not been changed in statute since 1977, of a relatively low dollar amount, simply means it really doesn't, it's not commensurate with, and that means we then have to jump to more accelerated steps to either remove the license or displace the provider.
Follow up,
we need to move on.
Well, if we're going to...
We're just going to vote on the amendments, and we'll have a work session on the bill at a later time.
We're talking about dropping one of the amendments, and I don't I think we're pushing too fast, but I'm curious how many facilities would have six infractions in a 90-day period and stiffer sanctions aren't being pursued.
Madam Chair, Representative Huffman, the way we view the bill for foster care, it's just set at $2,500 period. For other long-term care facilities, $2,500 is still the floor, and then you have an overall cap of $15,000. So I believe the way, and again, we would have to work with all of our stakeholders through the rulemaking process on, again, how those graduated penalties would work, but I would see for everything besides foster care, a $2,500 floor, and then we would go up to $10,000 or $15,000. And if there's more than one incident in the quarter, we simply wouldn't use civil penalties in additional incidents. We'd have to report. We'd have to rely on other means to try to resolve the problem.
So, but to the questions. Well, no, it's the original question.
There's a follow-up. Yes.
Okay. Six infractions in a 90-day period. Is that unusual? Or is it normal? Or,
Madam Chair, Representative Huffman, I didn't explain myself very well. We wouldn't look at six infractions. We would look at one infraction defined as one of these death, rape, sexual abuse, serious injury that results in permanent physical damage, et cetera, as a range between $2,500 and up to $10,000 or $15,000 per incident. And so we, and again, if it was really egregious, we wouldn't look at multiple events of $2,500. We would assess a much higher penalty, and then for the quarter, we'd be done. If there were additional incidents, we simply wouldn't be using civil penalties in additional incidents. We would have to resort to other means.
Madam Chair.
I can. Let's do it at home, and then we'll come back and do it. Representative Cowan.
Madam Chair, the Dash 7 amendments are very important to the industry, and I'm concerned about the integrity. I know that the the whole bill has been worked on very hard, and we need to move it forward. And I don't want to get lost into this one, but I don't sense that we've had the conversation about the Dash 7. It seems to me that we could move the bill with the Dash 2 and the Dash 9 and get the fiscal impact that we need, unless I'm missing something, and still allow us to have some further conversation on the Dash 7s. I actually am supportive of the Dash 7s because I know that it's very important to a number of the partners, but I understand the concern that's been raised, and I don't want to do anything that delays the progress of the bill as a whole. I don't want to lose the integrity of the bill lost in this one conversation, but I do think it's important as a separate conversation.
Okay, I think what we can do, Representative Gelser, is give us time to have an engrossed bill on Friday, and we could bring it up then to, and then we would have also the fiscal. Is that correct?
Madam Chair, if I understand the process correctly, I don't think that publications will engross the bill until you actually vote on the bill and pass it out of the committee. I would, however, be happy myself to hand engross the entire bill with both the Dash 7 and without the Dash 7 and to put the tree together. I cannot promise you that I could have that to you before the middle of the day tomorrow. It is a long bill, and it will take me a couple of hours to do that work. But I'm happy to do that. I also want to clarify just a comment that was made earlier, that there are a lot of people that have things to be unhappy with. If you think about the hearing that we had on this bill, you had a room full of people that traveled from all around the state to support this bill. Anytime you have a major shift in policy, there's questions because we can't know with certainty exactly what is going to happen next. This population of people heard us say that they had to wait last year in February when we met on this bill, and everyone came together to work very hard. This is a very, very good bill. I think there are elements of the bill that we will never have entire consensus on. I think this is a great example of one of them. But as Representative Cowan said, however you choose to proceed today, I hope it does not hold up overall. A very good bill whose time has come that has tremendous support across the state from all of the stakeholders and the primary things that the bill does. So thank you for letting me.
So I think Representative makes a great point. There is wide support for this, and I guess I still would like to move the amendments if people would agree to that. Right. And then we can get back to the stakeholders and make sure that they're supportive. I think we allowed James Taves to come before us today because I know that the agency feels that it's short on some of the issues that you would like addressed. But I think overall this has 99% support. And my fear is that it will get lost in the process if we don't start moving on it, because it has to go through the Senate as well as the House. So, yes, Representative Freeman.
Thank you, Chair Romaine. Just real quick. I have no doubt that this has been worked on and everybody's supportive of it. My only thing, and I'm new, I was handed 31 pages of amendments today and asked to vote on them, and I just would like a little time to read through them as all, and I'm sure I'm going to like everything that's there. It just seemed a little odd to have that much change all at once.
Yes, and you did get them by email yesterday, but I understand everybody's busy. Okay, so what I'm hearing people want is for us to hold this until Friday, and we'll have the engrossed bill so people can see it. And Representative Cowan.
Madam Chair, I feel that the Dash 7s have some question has been raised in people's minds, and if you'd like to move them all, then I just think that we should also hear testimony from a representative of the support system for the 7s. And if we could do, if you can give time for that.
We don't have time for that.
All right.
So what is the will of the committee?
Madam Chair?
Yes.
I think if we could wait till Friday, I would appreciate the couple of extra days.
Okay, we will do that.
Do I need to carry the motion then?
I think the motion probably just dies. We'll carry it over to carry the work session over till Friday. And
yes. Right. Okay, and in the meantime, maybe if you look it through carefully, and I think if the stakeholders who are in the building, if you could contact individual members of the committee, so if you do support this bill, so we can realize that there is wide support for this bill.
Yes. Thank you, Madam Chair, and it's not my intention to hold anything up, but I appreciate the time to read.
Yeah. Okay, thank you very much.
Do go ahead and officially announce that we'll carry the work session.
So we will carry the work session over on House Bill 2442 until Friday. I will close the work session on House Bill 2442. And I will reopen the hearing on 3353. And I would point out we have less than 45 minutes. So if you have written, come on ahead. If you have written testimony, please submit it. And if you could make your testimony very, very fast, I would be so happy. And we have Stephanie here, and then we have Anna Hilda and Gary Cobb. And if you have written testimony, please give it to Zach over here. And please speak quickly. Thank you.
Chair Tomei and members of the committee, my name is Judy Cushing, and I am president and CEO of Oregon Partnership, which is a statewide nonprofit providing alcohol and drug prevention, education, and crisis intervention services. We operate the state's suicide line. No single one issue impacts more agencies of government than alcohol and drug problems. And
Judy, if you're reading your testimony, I'm going to ask you to sum it up.
Yeah, and none have more ramifications than alcohol and drug problems, as you heard earlier today. Because states are the primary funders of alcohol and drug problems, they have the enormous potential to create more efficiency and to bring agencies together. So often in states, and you are well aware of this because you work on this every single day here in the Capitol, state agencies function in their own world and have their own strategies, and in so many instances, their own ways of doing business. They're focusing on their piece of the puzzle and aren't seeing the big picture. If leaders from the highest levels of government actually come together, the governor, the attorney general, judges, Department of Human Services, and other high-level governmental officials come together to look at the problem, they can lead a statewide strategy to improve prevention and treatment services. I want to bring before you just briefly the results of a national policy panel that was convened several years ago by Joined Together Boston University to analyze why and how state governments continue to pay dearly for the nation's failure to effectively prevent and treat alcohol and drug problems, and addresses Representative Van Horman's question earlier of Attorney General Kroger's comments. The panel's findings concluded that if the highest levels of leaders are fully engaged in the design of a plan, and then they have the ultimate authority to oversee that plan. In other words, they can hold state agencies and entities accountable for what they're doing. They are in the perfect position to crystallize positive change. This policy panel found that leadership and engaging the highest levels of leadership in a commission such as being proposed here today is really a very, very salient, not only a salient concept, but it is quite effective. We want to commend Attorney General Kroger for his vision. We want to commend the Governor's Council for their willingness to look at this issue as the entity that's presently in place, and, of course, the Governor's Office Superintendent Williams. For the small amount of funds that are being asked, I think, I don't know the amount, but I don't know that it's a large amount of funds. Attorney General mentioned a range this morning. The amount of funds that are being asked to fund this Alcohol and Drug Policy Commission, it is well worth it for Oregon to retool and relook at the way we're doing business around alcohol and drugs. I will tell you, from the Crisis Line's perspective, our calls are up 71%, 3,011 calls last month. Nearly a third of those were suicide calls. Our system, and we need to be able to help the people who are calling for help. And that's one of the tragedies, because it's really hard to run a crisis line if the people can't get services. So I urge you to carefully consider this proposal, and thank you for the time to testify today.
You too, Stephanie.
Chair Tomei, members of the committee, I'm Stephanie Suarez-Pump, chair of the Governor's Council on Alcohol and Drug Programs. I honestly never thought I'd be sitting here today. As I watched the testimony this morning, I sat here thinking, in my 33 years in the field, never would I have imagined the level of support and the direction it's coming from for this kind of an action. There are 26 state agencies and divisions that are impacted by alcohol and drug, and the charge of the council has been to assess the social and economic impacts on all of Oregon. Given that it crosses 26 agencies, that's a daunting task. But we have diligently, in my 5 years on the council, worked to fulfill that charge. House Bill 3353 brings us to a crossroads, one that's long overdue and that the council is pleased to be a part of. Many of us have spent years working to elevate the issue of prevention, treatment, and recovery, and have struggled with ways to make our case, tell our story, and to somehow convey to policymakers and the public how critically important the investment is in alcohol and drug prevention and treatment. The domino effect reports and the Oregon Speaks documents have helped pave the way to this crossroads. The council fully endorses the concept of converting our status to that of a commission, and we fully support the intent of the bill.
Stephanie, I have 15 more people.
Okay, there are amendments that will be coming to you that we have negotiated with the governor's office and the attorney general's office. There wasn't even an argument. We are in sync with what the amendments are needed, and I urge you to act on these quickly and get us over to the Senate for work on that side.
Thank you so much. Thanks for all your work on the council. You have 2 minutes.
2 minutes, okay. Chair Tomei, members of the committee, my name is Anna Hilde. I am a master's in public health student at Oregon Health and Science University, as well as a research assistant in the Department of Public Health and Preventive Medicine at OHSU, working with the Clinical Trials Network through the National Institute on Drug Abuse, looking at treatment effectiveness. I'm also a recovering drug addict, and I am here to say that I support this bill. I think it's an important step forward for the state of Oregon. I think that we do have treatment. We do have prevention programs. People are working very hard, but we have so much more improvement. We can make things better. And I just really want to say that treatment works, and I'm here to show that. And I just really want to put a human face on it. And this is a disease. And I like seeing that we're starting to look at maybe decriminalizing this illness. And people die from this illness, and that it affects our families, it affects our society, it affects our community. And when we as alcoholics and addicts get treatment, we can become productive members of the society. Thank you for letting me testify.
Thank you for coming to testify.
Madam Chair, may I just add one more thing?
Sure.
I'd like to acknowledge Mark Brandlin, who is here today. He's also a council member, and thank Mark for joining us this morning.
Thank you very much, and thank you for serving on the council. Thank you all very much for coming today. Sorry we're in such a rush. Gary Cobb?
Cobb.
Hi. Hi, Gary. You have 2 minutes.
2 minutes.
Okay. Right.
No pressure.
Madam Chair, committee members, my name is Gary Cobb, and I support House Bill 3353 for all the reasons that everybody before me that testified said. I also would like to say that I'm in long-term recovery. What that means is that I haven't used any drugs or alcohol or committed any crimes in over 8 years. So, you know, like the lady that testified right before me, treatment services do indeed work. But we have to make sure folks get those. I would like to add something in regards to how the bill is written. And, you know, I would like to frame stuff that drug prevention and drug treatment also in the way of recovery services, because it is a disease, and we have to kind of look at it, at that model, and treat it as such. So for me, what happened was I moved from active addiction into a detox setting, and got into a mentoring drug treatment program. Within that had a supportive housing, which meant there's an alcohol and drug-free setting. After that 4 months, I continued in an alcohol and drug-free environment in the way of housing. And on the tail end of that, there's access to employment services because that's what I needed. I've had jobs in the past that range from aerospace painting and you name it, but during that whole time, I was using. So I had really, you know, the jobs that I had just mainly supported my addiction. So the demand that I had to use was lost in the way that I had no guidance. And so all my heroes were people that used. All my heroes today are people that I get clean with, the people that testified before me that are trying to make a change. That's what happens, and that's a form of prevention. When you get people clean and get folks an opportunity to, you know, turn their lives around. That's what kids that have addicted parents, they look at their parents that are using, and so they're going to follow that model. If you get those parents clean, those kids are going to follow suit. So we have to streamline our approach to this, and I support House Bill 3353.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
For coming to testify. I really appreciate it. Sorry we had to rush you.
That's okay. I've been in that situation before.
Okay. Thank you. Okay, colleagues, I'm going to close the hearing on House Bill 3353 and open up the hearing on House Bill 2868. Oh, that's mine. Okay, Keely?
This bill requires the Department of Human Services to provide on a quarterly basis and at minimal cost orientation for child care providers who are not registered or certified but who receive funds from DHS for child care services. Requires the orientation to cover financial and food resources, reimbursements, and provider rights and responsibilities.
Representative Van Orman.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I presumed I was the lone person, so I apologize for immediately sitting down. This one, after the other two that we've looked at today, is very simple. It's simply asking the department to include those child care providers who are not registered or licensed but do, in fact, get reimbursed by the department to provide child care. It's essentially a kith and kin relationship. And so we're simply asking that those people be included in the training and the orientation because it eliminates a lot of the confusion in having been a child care provider, trying to perfect the system of submitting a bill for services you've rendered in child care and getting paid can be problematic. And sometimes you get overpaid and sometimes you get underpaid. And helping people before they get engaged in the business or during the period when you're engaged in the business to know how the system works should prevent a number of the problems that have occurred.
Great.
So I'm ready for questions.
Good. Any quick questions? Questions, I can almost say that. Thank you so much. And now we have Megan Moyer, Rebecca Tobin-Walker, and Sylvia Farr.
Okay.
And you each have 2 minutes. Sorry.
Chair Tomei, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Megan Moyer, and I'm here representing the Service Employee International Union, which represents over 20,000 care providers here in the state of Oregon and about 5,000 license-exempt child care providers who provide care through the state, either through the employment-related daycare program or the jobs program. The intention of 2868 is to make orientations mandatory for new providers entering into that program. These orientations are currently available but optional. 787 people since orientations became available have participated in the orientation, and we've seen a distinct difference between the understanding of the program, the access of enhanced trainings and the enhanced rate, and overall a smoother participation in the employment-related daycare program and the jobs program for those who have participated. And therefore, we feel like making orientations mandatory will be able to both alleviate some pretty significant confusion and overbilling problems the state has experienced, as well as enhance the quality of care provided by our child care providers who are license exempt. I've provided you with written testimony, and hopefully if you have questions, but I want to turn it over to Sylvia, one of our providers.
Hello, Chair Tomei, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Sylvia Farr, and I'm a child care provider providing care through the employment-related daycare program. I have been a child care provider off and on since 2000, and I'm currently been doing child care since 2006. And right now I'm being paid to watch two children through the ERDC program. I support mandatory orientation for license-exempt child care providers because this orientation, these orientations provide us with the information we need to fill out our paperwork correctly, including our timesheets, as well as the timeline for how long we need to keep our timesheets and records in case of a random audit. This information is important because it can prevent billing mistakes and overpayment issues. When I attended an orientation, I also learned about opportunities that help strengthen my abilities to as a provider, such as the enhanced rate training. I attended the program after signing up for orientation. Now I am certified in CPR and first aid. I have acquired my food handler's permit, and I am more knowledgeable in recognizing child abuse and neglect. I also learned who to contact if I have any problems about the billing forms and hours that I'm eligible to be paid for.
Do you have your materials written? And if so, would you be willing to give them to Zach, and I'll make sure that he'll copy it for everybody, and maybe you could just wrap up, and then we'll have copies to put
in
the bill file.
In conclusion, the orientation helps us as child care providers become more aware of our responsibilities and requirements, and the trainings that we sign up for help us to be more confident in handling emergencies and keeping our children safe. And mandatory orientations would help make sure license-exempt child care providers have access to important information and opportunities that orientations provide. Right now, many providers don't know about orientation, but by making it mandatory, it would eliminate many of these problems for other providers that I actually encountered before attending an orientation.
Thank you so much, and thanks for the work that you do.
No problem. I enjoy it.
Good. That's great. Okay.
She's here as a resource if there were questions.
Oh, okay. Any quick questions?
Real quick.
Yes, Representative Freeman.
Thank you, Chair Tomei. How is it that people will receive this training? I mean, is it a go to a class? Do we already provide the training in rural areas? How does that work?
Chair Tomei, Representative Freeman, these orientations are currently available. They are optional. They are available in every service district within Oregon and are provided by the Resource and Referral Network, who also help families connect with child care providers. So, yes, these trainings are currently going on statewide, but are not mandatory.
Just a quick follow-up. Sorry.
Follow-up?
You say service districts. I'm sorry, I don't know the context of that. But let me do a for example. If we have somebody that wants to provide child care in Lakeview, are they able to go close, or do they have to travel a long ways? Is it available over the Internet? How's the training?
It is an in-person orientation. Every county has it. It's the DHS divides its children and families into service areas, and they're very similar. They're almost entirely county lines,
okay.
And that's how it's done.
Thank you.
It's a common sense bill.
Okay, thank you so much. And now we have Shannon Vandehey, Karen Garcia, and Carrie Winkler, right? Mm-hmm. Odette?
Have I called up Vic?
No, because I put him on that list.
Okay.
So.
And Vic will have you up last. And you've got 2 minutes or less. Sorry to speed you up, but we have a lot of people from the next bill who are wanting to speak.
Good morning. My name is Karen Garcia, and I am the Enhanced Rate Program Coordinator for Child Care Information Service. And Child Care Information Service is the resource and referral agency for Marion, Polk, and Yamhill counties.
I'm here to support the House Bill 2868, and as a part of my job, I'm responsible for coordinating the DHS enhanced rate trainings that Representative Friedman just asked about in our service delivery area. The orientations are a wonderful opportunity for providers to learn valuable information about providing child care for DHS families. Most of the friend, family, neighbor providers, or kith and kin providers, do not consider themselves professional child care providers, but rather are just doing a favor for friends or family. They often become overwhelmed in a system full of various agencies, processes, and politics. But between case managers, direct payment, and parents, child care providers are often in the dark about how to get listed with DHS, how to get paid, and how to troubleshoot sticky situations with the parents that they are doing care for. Much of the class time is spent explaining how to properly fill out forms, how to, you know, which boxes to fill in, how to receive their payment in the timeliest fashion, and we also spend time discussing what else, other resources, and other trainings that are available to these friend, family, neighbor providers. Most providers are unaware that they probably qualify to participate in the USDA food program, which actually comes out to their home and will help help them pay for the food that they're providing to the children, and also the enhanced rate program, which can get them CPR and first aid certified, get them how to recognize and report child abuse and neglect, and get them a food handler card. Licensed providers are required to go to attend child development trainings, but unfortunately there are no requirements for friend, family, neighbor providers to do any sort of training, despite the fact that they're caring for a population of children. So it's really important to us to get them into these, I'm going to drop my notes because I'm more nervous reading them. It's really important for us to get them into these trainings, because then once they come to our into our agency, it opens a door for them to be able to go out and find opportunities for other trainings, like child development, like I said, CPR and first aid. And we really would ask that you make these mandatory in order for them to see what other opportunities are out there.
Karen, where are you situated?
Here in Salem. So
okay.
We work for
you know
Mary
what I'd like
Polk
to do? We could call you back at a later time. What I'm trying to do is I see lots of people here from out of Salem.
Okay.
So what I'd like to do is hear from those folks so they won't have to travel again.
Okay.
So would that be okay with
yeah,
you?
Yeah, that's fine.
And I see
no problem.
That you have something written, and if you could
yeah,
get
it's
that
just handwritten.
That.
I hope that I'm sorry.
That's okay. Don't worry about it.
Okay.
Take it home. If you don't mind typing it up, or we can type it up.
Okay.
And then we'll have that information. And how about you? Are you from Salem?
I'm the program director of CCIS.
Okay. So what I'd like to do is call you back at another time.
Oh, that's
if that
fine.
Would work for you.
Okay.
That
that's
would be
fine.
Great.
Thank All right.
you so much.
Thank you,
Is there anyone
Chair.
Else who is wanting to speak on this bill who is from outside of Salem? Okay. And Vic, I know you want to speak on this. What I'd like to do is I'll have a hearing at another time. And have you come in? Would that work? Okay, so I'm going to be closing the hearing on House Bill 2868.
We did.
And opening up the hearing on House Bill 2835. And who is presenting this bill? Keely, go ahead.
It prohibits the Department of Human Services from adopting rules to prevent otherwise qualified employees of the department from operating a foster home. And I believe Megan is.
Okay, Megan, come ahead. And then what I'd like to do is invite people who are wanting to speak on this bill who are from out of Salem. I would allow you to speak first.
Chair, to members of the committee, again, for the record, Megan Moyer with the Service Employee International Union. I will be extremely brief about the explanation of this bill because I think our members are the most powerful testimony.
Great.
This bill, House Bill 2835, is in response to a policy that was implemented by the Department of Human Services about 2 years ago, prohibiting employees in the Children and Family Division from serving as foster parents and adoptive parents. This has resulted in many staff either leaving the department entirely, moving departments, or having to cease serving the children that either they were in the process of adopting or not being able to continue as foster parents. This bill has come directly from our membership. It is a policy in which our DHS members are passionate about and feel there was a pretty strong disconnect between the decisions made by the policymakers at the top and the impacts on the frontline workers and the children that they serve. We fully understand the complexity of this issue and the need to even guard against the perception of preferential treatment, but we ask that the committee balance that with the best interests of children and that our DHS workers have for decades before this policy served as foster and adoptive parents, have unique qualifications for dealing with the special needs of the children we're seeing, their complex behavioral, emotional, and physical needs, and that this policy needs to also balance the desperate need of children in our child welfare system and our lack of placements and permanent placements and qualified placements for complex cases. Thank you.
Thank you, Megan. Any quick questions? Megan, thank you so much for bringing this bill to us. So what I'm going to do is invite people who are from the out of the Salem area, if you would come up first. Come ahead. And I'm going to ask Will to speak pretty quickly because we have quite a few people wanting to testify. Go ahead.
Hi, my name's Irma Hamilton, Representative Tomei, Chair. I'd like to share my experience real briefly with the DHS and what I think are some conflicts of interest for them being foster parents. I already had, 5 years ago, I had an established relationship with Children's Services. I initiated involvement with them. September 1st, 2004, I called for placement for my 5 sons because I was under attack physically, police report, and in a federal HUD investigation, and we were getting terrorized. I was told from Children's Services, no, September 13th, 2004, I was arrested and my 5 sons placed in foster care. All of them were placed under DHS caseworkers with them. 2 of them were further separated, and so 3 remained with DHS Children's Services workers. Here's some of the highlights that I wanted to go over.
I'm just a little bit confused. When you say they're placed in the homes of a DHS worker, is that what you meant? Or they're placed?
Yes. Yes, madam.
Okay, thank you.
I am so nervous. The caseworkers, they get to cherry pick the prettiest, the brightest, the least troubled of the kids. I don't think it's fair to other foster parents. They have the inside track of, you know, all these with these kids. They know where the special monies are allocated. One of my sons was with 2 foster parents, DHS caseworkers, and he was labeled special needs, so they were allowed more money. He never was special needs before, and so they have labels for extra monies. I complained to this, checkups aren't properly addressed when DHS caseworkers are foster parents. My one son complained he wasn't getting enough food. I complained to Children's Services while he was in foster care, and it was never addressed. And my oldest son complained, still have pictures of it, of being attacked while he was in foster care, and nothing was addressed with the foster parent from DHS. In fact, we lost visit for several months. The other conflict of interest, main thing too, is I just opened up a small business and I have 4 of my 5 sons back. I'm still fighting for the 5th one, and this is 4.5 years later. It's hard enough, the battles that we have to go establishing, getting us back together. I opened up a small business. I went to apply for services, and lo and behold, there's a foster parent from my past. I was treated very poorly, and not her in particular, but another worker for these services asked if I was educated. I said, excuse me, I have a bachelor's degree, I have my own business, and I'm trying to do what I can. I do not think it is good for Children's Services, DHS caseworkers to be foster parents unless more is in place. Thank you.
Excuse me, I didn't hear, unless...
And more checks and balances from another agency.
Thank you.
So you didn't say it, but I'm assuming you're opposed to the bill.
Yes.
Is but I just want to make sure I understood. Go ahead. Thank you for your testimony.
Chair Tomei, members of the committee, thank you for hearing us today. My name is Janet Martin. I'm here as an SEIU member and a prospective adoptive parent. When this policy was implemented, I had two immediate concerns. One was personal. One was professional. At the time that this policy was enacted, I did work for child welfare as a foster home certifier, and my role was to place children quickly with relatives or friends so that they did not have to spend time in stranger foster care. The many levels of management that this policy required let me know immediately that we would not be able to do what I was doing, which was keeping children connected with their families because of the number of exceptions that had to be granted through multiple layers of management. I'm sorry, I'm very nervous.
That's okay.
It's very emotional for me. My personal concern was my husband and I had just completed an adoption home study through Boys and Girls Aid Society in hopes of adopting a child out of foster care or possibly two children. This policy was enacted without giving any consideration to those of us already in the process. The union arranged for, the union arranged for a question and answer session with those responsible for implementing this policy approximately 5 months after they implemented it, and they could not answer any of the questions that were posed. And these were all basic questions about implementation of the policy and how it would affect children waiting for forever families. I spent probably a good 6 months trying to communicate with folks in Salem about who were responsible for implementing this policy about how it would affect my situation. I, 9 times out of 10, was ignored. My phones and emails went unanswered. When I was responded to, I was given multiple answers that contradicted one another.
Janet, I'm somewhat confused. Are you an employee of DHS?
I was an employee. I left because of this policy.
I see.
Okay. I left the child welfare a year ago.
Okay.
Ultimately, I was told that my choice was to, I was told rather brusquely by the HR manager for child welfare that I had a choice to stay in my position and I could adopt privately, which is not an economic reality for my husband and I, he is a teacher, or I could stay in my job and not adopt. My other concern about this bill is there were already numerous protections in place to prevent conflicts of interest. There is an Oregon administrative rule that has 3 requirements for adoptions that are undertaken by employees of the agency. Number one, they have to go through a private agency so that they're not represented by DHS. We did that. We went through a private agency. Number two, employees could not be considered for children in their district where they worked. Number three, the adoption committee would have to take place in Salem at a sensitive issue committee where none of the members knew the employee. There are many protections in place. This administrative rule is still in effect. I think it provides adequate protection. Thank you.
Thank you, Janet. If you have written testimony, that would be terrific if you could hand it in.
I only have one copy.
That's
fine. Okay? Okay.
Zach will make copies for us. Thank you. Go ahead.
Thank you, Chair Tomei and members of the committee. My name is Adele Newton. I'm an MSW. I'm a DHS caseworker, but I'm not here on behalf as a worker at DHS. I'm here as a member of SEIU and an Oregon resident. I live in Southwest Portland. I've been a caseworker and a foster parent for about 10 years, and I have 2 boys in my care who've been in my care for 7 years. They're a sibling group and they're teens now, and when this policy came into effect a couple of years ago, I was pretty distraught and scared that, my boys who'd been in my home, who don't have any other relatives or parents that are viable resources for them, were going to have to be moved. And I was worried about that, how that was going to impact them. As I'd been in my home already for 5 years, the policy has a thing in place where you could kind of get grandfathered in if you were already caring for kids, but it still has to be reviewed every year by lots of different people, and so there's still the potential that they could be moved, you know, or, and I mean, that's always the case in foster care, but, you know, it's kind of creates some uncertainty for me and also for my foster kids who deserve to have a permanent placement. They don't have anywhere else to go. So I would like to continue being a foster parent. This policy means that I can't do that once my kids are out of my home. They've aged, they're going to age out pretty soon. One of them's 20. The other one is 17. So I feel like it's keeping me from doing what I want to do, which is to help other kids and to be a foster parent for other children. And I'm not able to do that now because of this bill, unless I were to leave the agency, which I don't want to do. I've been at the same job for 10 years. I love my job. I love being a foster parent. So it's kind of a tough situation to be in. I do want to address some of the concerns that the woman before me had mentioned about her children who had been placed with caseworkers at DHS. And one of the things I think that she mentioned was that she felt that that her concerns weren't investigated. I've had out-of-home care investigations for the children in my care. And those allegations were assessed just as any other foster parent would be. I had a CPS worker come knock on my door, or come in and interview my kids, interview me. That's not been my experience that I've gotten kind of special treatment because I'm a caseworker. As far as the special rate situation with getting special rates for kids in your care, they're most foster parents, if you've been a foster parent for very long, they know what the resources are. So you don't have to be a DHS caseworker to know that you can get a special rate for your kid, or you can get clothing vouchers, or you can get this or that. And because I'm a caseworker and I work in the agency and I know the budget constraints that we have, I feel like I probably save the state money because I don't ask for those things, because I know how irritating it is to me as a caseworker for somebody to call me up and say, will you pay this $13 lost book fee for my kid? And I'm like, you're getting a special rate of $900. Or whatever. So I don't ask my caseworker for my kids to, you know, for clothing vouchers. I don't ask them to pay for school supplies. I know that those are resources, but most other foster parents know those are resources as well. It doesn't have anything to do.
We need to move on because we have several other people.
I put a lot of stuff in my written.
Yes, I appreciate that. And we will read that.
The only last thing I think I would want to say is, and I'm sure other people here would say the same thing, is that we don't really need this policy. We already have procedures in place to protect against conflicts, and it eliminates a huge pool of potential resources. I have a really difficult time placing kids in foster homes. When I became a foster parent...
Adele, we need to move on.
I'm sorry.
Thank you.
Okay.
I'll be real quick. I'll read really quickly. Chair Tomei, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Dino Sanagusti. Today, my testimony is based on my over 23 years of experience working for the state of Oregon, both as a social service specialist and equally in central office, taking a hard look at the foster care system for the state of Oregon and its redevelopment with policies, et cetera. So I, fortunately, not only professionally got to take a look at foster care from the angle of a DHS employee, but equally as a foster and as an adoptive parent.
You cannot read fast enough to read three pages of material.
Yeah, okay.
We have this, and I promise we will read it if you will just sum up.
Okay,
your
so basically, in summary, my position is this policy is not needed. You know, the adage is, why fix something that's not broken? And the system was working. And what I don't quite understand is child reform in Oregon really took a hard look at the limited homes that are available for children languishing, literally languishing in foster care. And by limiting our pool of qualified applicants, it really raised to the level of therapeutic foster homes, equally like group homes. If you're limiting a pool of homes that could potentially raise some of Oregon's most special need children. My advantage that I had was my experience and the hope that I injected into families, working with families, because by default we took children that were in the foster care system and were blessed to work with their family members that helped children reunite with family members that still keep in contact with their family. Fortunately, we adopted a child that's now a young man and very productive in the community, and I'm very blessed at that. Fortunately, unlike Adele, I didn't need to be grandfathered in. Prior to the whole rule change, we decided to stop fostering, primarily because we were done. it's a tough job, combined with our work. So today I do support House Bill 2835 in response to the first person that testified before you. It's unfortunate that her experience was soured because of the work of others. It's not a reflection of workers in general. We genuinely do care, and we genuinely work on drawing that line and not getting ourselves in a conflicted situation.
Thank you, Dina. Thank you for the work you've done, both of you. Go ahead.
Hi, Chair Tomei, committee members. My name is Michelle McAllister, and I'm here as an SIU member, a former foster parent, and I'm also a child welfare employee. I have worked for the state for over 7 years, and I had a coworker approach me who had been trying to find a placement for two teenage boys for over a year. They were very behaviorally challenged, and she was left with the option that she was going to have to separate. My husband and I didn't have children of our own, and she approached me and was like, have you ever thought of fostering? And we actually had fostered in the past, one of my niece's friends who came in the system briefly. So I said, well, you know, we have, but I hadn't thought of it as doing that while I'm working for the agency. A long story short, I submitted a letter, a conflict of interest request, was approved by my supervisor and approved by Salem, and with the approval of their boys, they came into our home, checked us out, and said, yep, can't be any worse than any place else we've ever lived. And they became our children, and we did permanency with our younger son. Our older son did not choose to do permanency, neither wanted to be adopted, but they are our forever children. They're now 20 and 21. They both serve the military and are serving their country, which is amazing after languishing in the foster care system their entire life. And this story would not have happened. We would not have our forever family, and they would be alone in the world except for those two if this policy had been implemented when I was working back in 2001. So I just would like to say I support this House Bill 2835. On the other hand, I also want to talk about the short-term benefits foster workers can have. Is I still mentor a teenage girl who lived with us briefly as we tried to preserve a placement. That was a call from a certifier. It was a, you know, emergency call. We're trying to preserve a placement. Can you help us? You have the skills to work with this kid. It was a month placement, but it's turned into a four-year relationship. That could not have happened with this new policy that DHS has implemented. It's the children are falling to the back of the line, and as workers, we're just shocked because this is why we're in the field. We love kids. We're passionate. We're not just passionate on the job. We're passionate about it 24/7 and in our personal lives as well.
Thank you. Thank you for the work you do, all of you. Thank you so much. Was there anyone else from out of Salem who wanted to testify on this very quickly? I have about two words. Fantastic. Okay.
Why? Talk about time management.
Yes, I was working hard on that. Thank you so much for coming. Thanks for all that you do. You didn't even get to say anything today.
I'm not from out of Salem.
Well, we will have probably another hearing on this bill, and we'll hear from people in Salem who are wanting to speak. With that, I will close the hearing on House Bill 2835, and I will close the House Committee on Human Services. Thank you.